Recision and its consequences, and pierogies in space.
The most controversial ad we've ever seen in our lives, and more TikTok book talk drama. Welcome to Downsampled News. Hello and welcome to Downsampled News. My name is Belok and I'm here with my father,
Richie B.
And it's almost like we're related. And we are here today, beginning of August, to cover the news from
July.
The past month, July 2025. And for me, it was kind of a slow news month to the extent that I don't want to talk about Jeffrey Epstein. So, exactly. There has been so much coverage, and that's totally fair, but like the market is saturated. Let's not and say we did. So, but you have interesting topics to bring. I just have gossip, but you have actual interesting news topics.
So I obsessively follow going-ons in the Congress, and I was going to cover something else, but this rescission bill came up. So do you know what the rescission is?
I do not.
So rescission has to do with budgeting, and there's some interesting potential consequences to what happened. So let's just talk about what rescission is and how it works. So typically when a government creates the budget, it's the money is allocated by the House. House of Congress. They produce a budget. Well, the White House often sends suggestions or requests, and they typically ignored. And basically, they come up with a very detailed budget allocating money for various different things. It has to be passed through the House. Then it goes to the Senate, where it has to be passed by required 60 votes because it can be filibustered. So these 60 people have to vote for it, which means any budget that has passed requires Democrats, which means that the budget may contain things that Democrats want. And then it goes to the president who signs it and so on. Now, there was a law passed back in the 70s, I believe, that allow some for something called rescission, meaning you want to just undo some parts of the budget. And the way it works is that the White House can request of the Congress saying, please remove such and such things from the budget. So
basically Congress sends a budget to the White House and the president can be like, whoa, whoa, hold on.
Well, no, the president signs the budget, budget's in place. Then later on, president can say, I know you want us to spend money on this. So it goes, legally, he's supposed to go to Congress and say, can you please pass the rescission bill which removes the money from the budget. Right. So it goes to the House. They talk about it, decide what's in it, and they pass it. Then it goes to the Senate. And the funny part about rescission is that only majority is required to pass it. The rescission, it cannot be filibustered. So which has interesting implications.
Odd.
So what happened this time, you know, with Doge and all that silliness.
Remember Doge?
Basically, what they're trying to do is make some of the Doge cuts or refuse to spend money official. So they ask, White House asked the House to produce a bill to rescind some money. They create a bill that rescinded $9 billion. Now, that sounds like a lot of money.
Yeah.
But really, no. It's probably less than 1% of the federal budget. It's probably a fraction of a percent.
Wow.
If you want to think about federal budget, imagine if we spend $1 billion a month on defense. That would be a huge defense cut.
Oh, my goodness.
Actually, no, I'm sorry. It would be worse. It's like $1 billion a day. If we spend $1 billion a day on defense, that would be a big, that would be like almost 50% defense cut.
I don't like understand the number billion. I know it exists, but like I can't. Like the best I ever. Well, so you ever see that guy that made the videos? Maybe you guys have seen it. Our viewers have seen it. The guy that made the videos with the piles of rice representing the amount of money. That's the closest I ever got to understanding the number billion. So like that's crazy that it's. What are we buying?
Yeah. So somebody said if you calculate how long it takes to spend the amount of money, if you spend a dollar a day, you know, it took very long to. But anyway, so $9 billion is a relatively small amount of money. And what they cut was they cut $1.3 billion from PBS and NPR.
Oh, I heard about this. Yes, the cuts to the public
radios. So basically, there was a corporation for public broadcasting that supplied money to various local stations for public radio. That's gone. So that corporation is shutting down now. And NPR also. Now, both PBS and NPR get lots of their funding from donations of members like me.
Yay.
So, yes, please support your local PBS and NPR stations. Mm-hmm. And the rest of the money went out from foreign aid.
Okay.
So there was an interesting exception that they did. If you remember George Bush... George W. Bush.
Unfortunately, yes.
Well, he did some good things. One of the things, he started this program, international program to prevent AIDS. And they were about to cut that as well. So they removed that from his rescission bill. So that will continue for now.
Okay.
And it was also a small amount of money. And the large scheme of things was up to $400 million.
Yeah. Producing and distributing AIDS medication is not expensive.
No.
So... like the concept that like we have to cut something like that is ridiculous. Like that's a pittance in comparison.
Anyway, so that's what happened this time around. Mm-hmm. And the problem is now that this is like in the House, Democrats will now no longer necessarily be motivated to even work on budgets. Mm-hmm. Because if they work on budgets and get the budget passed, and then after it's enacted, the Republicans turn around saying, oh, well, let's remove the stuff that Democrats put in there because we don't like it. And that makes it very less likely for Democrats to cooperate on budgets.
Yeah.
And apparently there is some negotiations happening between the Republicans and Democrats in Congress and the White House, where Democrats are saying... Democrats have been holding up a lot of the nominations that Trump had put in for various positions. So there's like procedural things that they can do to slow things down. Mm-hmm. So they said, we will release some of your nominations and we will work on the budget, but you have to not do rescissions. Otherwise, in September, government shuts down because the budget runs out at the end of September. If there's no new budget or there is no continuing resolution, which remember we talked about a year ago, the government shut down. So in the previous, you know, with the continuing resolution last time, Democrats were more motivated to try to keep the government open, thinking that Republicans might be more reasonable. I think Democrats are getting pissed off more and more.
I mean, one thing I always say about people just generally is, you know, don't make someone tell you who they are twice. Like, if someone shows you who they are, first of all, they tell you with their words, listen. But if they show you who they are for their action, like, that's who they are. If they're non-trustworthy and they're not someone who's going to work with you, why? Like, there is no reason to continue to put yourself out there. I mean, one thing about Donald Trump and the Republicans that follow him is that Donald Trump's very much like, you scratch my back, I punch you in the fucking face. Right? Like, there's no reciprocity. There's no loyalty. There's nothing. And I work with, I work in criminal law and I work with a lot of prosecutors, you know, in various courthouses. And there are prosecutors that I know are like professional and we can work together and we can resolve things. And there are prosecutors that I know are not trustworthy, that I know from experience, there's no point for me putting a good foot forward and trying to do something for them because they're never going to return that for me. And like, you need to know that about people. And with the Democrats, I wouldn't be voting for anything. I'd say, we made these agreements and then you use a loophole that really shouldn't exist. Because that's really interesting.
Well, from what I've read on Wikipedia, not that I'm an expert on this, there was a law passed in the 70s that was trying to limit the executive's power to impound money, not to pay out the stuff that was...
Right.
So they added this process so they could official. There would be an official process to pull money back.
But the amount of votes should match.
Well,
like, that's the thing.
So here's the thing that could happen, right? So. Mm-hmm. Well, Democrats, the Republicans are threatening to override some of the Senate rules that allow them to pass things by just majority vote instead of requiring 60. Mm-hmm. And that's called nuclear option. Mm-hmm. But the other thing that when you think about it, imagine a couple of years where there's a Democratic House and Democratic Senate, Democratic President, mm-hmm. and the president, and the budget is passed, and the president decides that they want to rescind all the money for ICE.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The problem is that the problem we have, like, this is a bigger issue in terms of American politics. It's too big for the extent of this podcast. But the problem we have is that we have one party, the Democrats, that are at least attempting to act like in a responsible way. Mm-hmm. Or like an adult way, and the other party that's just like doing whatever they want.
Right. So there's, I think Democrats are slowly getting out of that. They mm-hmm. kind of try to follow the rules and the norms, and they're getting punched in the face.
Right. Exactly.
And I think they're getting tired of it. There mm-hmm. is a, so you know about game theory?
Vaguely, yes.
Game theory is a branch of mathematics.
Oh boy, math.
But well, the one thing that I would mention is, which kind of applies in this thing, is that in many games, one of the strategies to either stay even or win is called tit for tat. Mm-hmm. So if your opponent does a certain move, you do the same. Mm-hmm. And we see that happening with redistricting.
Yeah, right? I heard about this.
There's Texas is planning to redistrict their state.
To try to get more Republican seats,
right.
basically.
And California and New York are saying, well, if you can do it, so can we.
They were actually talking about this on, do you watch The Coffee Klatch with Robert Reich? And
not really. I know.
I actually really like it. I think it's
I like Robert Reich. Yeah.
Yeah. No, he's very smart. I'm so sorry. I forgot the woman's name who's on there, but she's also great. If you could look it up, because I know I feel really bad because she's wonderful and I love her and I just have brain fog. But they were talking about this redistricting issue on their last episode from this past week. And in question, like, do you respond in kind and say, like, okay, you want to redistrict Texas, we'll do it for New York, we'll do it for California, we'll do all these blue states, we'll just do the same thing and match you, basically? Or is that bad to do because then you're, like, stooping to their level? And I've always been a pragmatist, so I'm kind of like, whatever practically gets you there. And it's like, if they're like gaming the system, but the system is allowing them to do that, then yeah, take advantage of that. Yeah. Why not? Like, game it right back.
Absolutely. I mean, that's part of the game theory mm-hmm. thing with tit for tat. So I think Republicans are kind of playing with fire here, because mm-hmm. when they lose power and Democrats decide, you know, President Gavin Newsom decides to rescind all the money for ICE.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's got to... There's going to be a reduction in ICE regardless, one way or the other, because there's no way that's going to continue. It's such an unpopular position.
Yeah. One interesting thing about this whole ICE thing, I guess we're going a little bit off topic.
Yeah.
But they want to hire lots of people.
Yeah.
And it's hard to find trained people and stuff. One of the things they're offering is forgiveness for student loans for anybody who joins. Mm-hmm. And that was declared not constitutional by the Supreme Court when Joe Biden tried to forgive mm-hmm. student loans. So let's see where that goes.
Yeah. All right. Her name is Heather Lofthouse. And I love her. I think she's great. And mm-hmm. I really like their chat. So plug for Robert Reich and Heather Lofthouse, because they need the plug from us. I'm sure our three viewers already watched The Coffee Klatch.
Anyway, so this is kind of rescission and its consequences, potential consequences.
I didn't even know this existed.
Neither did I.
I had no idea.
And on my way back from my band camp, I was mm-hmm, listening yeah. to some podcasts.
He went to band camp for a week. It was very cute.
It was lovely. It was fantastic. I listened to podcasts when they talked about this, and I didn't realize what the consequences might be. Mm-hmm. So
this is interesting, just to add on to this, like, legally, there's, I forget what, like, the concept is called in law, but there's, like, this prevalent concept in the law, generally, that, like, you want things to match logically. Like, the best example I could give is, like, if you have someone who is, like, sentenced to a crime, like, they go to trial, they're convicted, they get sentenced, mm-hmm. and, like, 5 years later, a higher court is like, you need to be re-sentenced because of, like, whatever. There was something that wasn't considered. You need to be resentenced. When that resentencing comes back, the same procedure has to happen on the resentence that happened on the sentence. So all the same rights that existed at the sentence exist at the resentence. So, like, when you do it again, it matches the original. It's so weird to me that you could pass a budget that requires 60 votes, but then amend it with less than that. I actually think the way it should be, the law should mirror there, is that you need not only 60 votes, but the same 60 votes.
Not even the law. Those are rules in the Senate. And the Senate rules are voted on at the beginning of every Senate session every year. And currently, two-thirds of the Senate has to agree to pass all the rules.
Right. So maybe they could change that in the future. Yeah, interesting. More you know.
The more you know. So much for shenanigans in Congress.
Yes. Okay, so my first topic is less real news and more internet drama. Because I am chronically online and I have never once in my life gone outside and touched grass, I have been following the Sydney Sweeney American Eagle debacle. Are you aware of this at all?
I heard of this recently, Sydney Sweeney something jeans.
Something jeans, yes, that's exactly. So basically, I don't want to preface this by saying I don't really know who Sydney Sweeney is, so I don't think any of this is her fault. I think she was just the actress hired to do this ad.
Right.
And I'm sure they said, here's many millions of dollars, and she didn't think, like, let me do a deep analysis of the script.
She's a good-looking blonde.
Exactly. So the premise of the ad, and my understanding now is that the original ad has been pulled. So if you go search it, you might not be seeing the original. But because, again, chronically online, I saw the original when it kind of broke and began, this whole thing began. Basically, it's a jeans ad. It's a white woman with blonde hair and blue eyes and jeans. And she's like talking sexy into the camera. So it's a regular jeans ad. But the original ad started with her saying, your jeans determine a lot about who you are. Your hair color, your personality, your eye color. And so then we realized, like, okay, they're making a play on the word jeans, right? Because jeans can be your pants, and jeans can be short for genetics, like your genetic makeup. Why we're talking about genetic makeup in a clothing ad? Question marks. And so we go on from there. So she's like, jeans can determine how you look, basically your personality, whatever. And then she says some other shit in the middle there.
Doesn't she say something inheritance?
Something about inheritance, yeah. Like, she's talking about, like, genetics genes. And then the ad at the end is, like, she's like, my genes are blue. Which is obviously, again, a play on, like, the fact that jeans, the clothing, are traditionally blue. Like, denim is traditionally blue. And her eyes are blue. But then the tagline for this, the ad, is Sydney Sweeney has good genes. Which is a little bit eugenicist. And not hard to see. So the internet kind of lost its mind. And there's a really interesting debate now, because there was the initial internet losing its mind about the ad. Then there was the backlash to the people losing their mind. There was the backlash to the backlash. So, you know, we have this, like, wonderful internet wave happening that you see on everything. And I love it. I love seeing it happen. I do think the initial backlash to the ad was appropriate, because for a few reasons. I understand you can make a pun on the word jeans in the English language, that jeans sounds the same for the piece of clothing and your genetics. But beyond that, I don't know why anyone greenlit this. And it's one of those things where, of course, they were trying to make an ad about how, first of all, saying the phrase someone has good genes is like innately eugenicist, because you're saying there's a difference between people's genes, and that genes can be good or bad. Like, the concept that genes can be morally good or bad is like a eugenicist concept. See what I'm saying? That there's, like, better, there are people that are, like, innately better than others because of their genes. Mm-hmm. So it's, like, probably a bad, poor phrase to be saying in your global ad campaign, American Eagle. And then, like, of course they pick, like, a generically pretty, like, white, blonde-haired, blue-eyed woman. And of course the ad is, like, about the fact that she has blue eyes. You know, and it's one of those things where when I was watching it, my first thought was, like, they could have done it differently, where they did, like, you know, a whole bunch of different people and said, like, you know, instead of my genes are blue, like the color, they could have said, like, you know, my genes are strong, my genes are powerful, my genes are resilient. You know, like, they could have done, like, a woman's empowerment. They could have done that.
Yeah.
And instead they did this. And I do think it's problematic for that reason. So the initial backlash I understood. Then there was the backlash to the backlash, which was a bunch of people being like, it's just an ad, calm down. So there's sort of two arguments on this. It's just an ad, calm down. And the ad isn't saying it's that she's white. The ad is saying that she's pretty. So she has good genes because she's pretty. So to the first point, it's not the world's worst ad. We've seen worse ads than this. So I agree to the extent, like, it is just an ad. But, like, you know, when you put media out into the world, it's there to be critiqued. And if people on a whole are like, that looks racist.
Do you know about the Brooke Shields jeans ad, which yes. which this kind of played on?
Yeah, this played on that. She was underage at the time of that, and which was another a whole other thing. Brooke Shields, poor Brooke Shields. So, like, I think some of the you know, the internet's the internet. Some people overreact, but I do think there was like a legitimate reaction here. This is one of those reasons that I watch Pod Save America and I just want to take them and shake them vigorously. Because the guys at Pod Save America missed it completely. They're like, this isn't about eugenics. This has nothing to do with racism, whatever. And I'm like, are you fucking blind? Like, how stupid are you? So I was just like, I want to just take him and shake him. But, and then to the people that were like, the ad is about Sydney Sweeney having good genes because she's pretty. I want to bring us back to like, why are we talking about the genetics of the model wearing the jeans? I'm so confused.
It's all fault of English language.
It's all the fault of the English, yes, exactly.
No, and this would not work in Spanish, let's say.
No, or Polish.
Or Polish.
It wouldn't work in Polish. And it's like, I wonder about it because I know it's not accidental because I know how much it takes to get something.
Yeah, I think they got carried away with the pun, I think.
The most generously I can get is that they got carried away with the pun. You know who didn't get carried away with the pun? The less talked about Dunkin' Donuts ad.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know about this one.
Most people don't. So and this is less talked about because the Sydney Sweeney one kind of took off first. But 2 days later, Dunkin' Donuts, which I love. You know me. I'm a Dunkin' girl. I didn't get Dunkin' for like 3 days after this ad. That was my form of protest. but what can I do? I live in a capitalist hellscape and that is the place I get coffee. Dunkin' Donuts released an ad that I'm pretty sure is still up and about for their golden hour sunset drink or some such thing. It's one of these like bright orange drinks that's full of sugar and delicious. Where they had an actor, again, I don't know who, he's from some TV shows, generically handsome guy, generically handsome white guy, blue eyes, you know,
like
the
whole
thing. Yeah, just like you, exactly. but he's like very tan, like he goes out in the sun and like gets tan. So it seemed like the concept behind the commercial was like the golden hour drink, the golden hour sun, the golden hour tan. Like that was like maybe the original kind of concept. But what it came out to was him starting the commercial by saying, it's like, it's not my fault. I look this tan. I have good genetics. And I'm like, what? And then it's like a commercial about him bragging about having a good tan and like having good genes, like genetic genes, and also drink this. And I'm like, at least in the American Eagle ad, you could like, there was a pun, but in the Dunkin' Donuts ad, it was just, I'm handsome because my genes are good, and also I'm a white guy with blue eyes. Drink this, and I just don't understand what's happening in the marketing room because it passes. So many people have to approve these things.
That sounds to me like somebody just ad-libbed and they just kept it and overlooked it.
Yeah, I mean it really genuinely. But I know it goes like these marketing things go through so many steps. So anytime you see something,
oh, I know AI.
Ah, AI did it. That's what it was. But they like genuinely marketing goes through so many steps and passes so many hands that. Like nothing done in marketing is accidental. And so that's why every now and then when there is like something that seems to be a genuine accident, like people like it's very funny, but I very rarely think any marketing things are accidental because of the amount of people involved in approving things. Same thing with like TV shows. like the amount of people involved in like getting something from like concept to finished product, there's like hundreds of people involved. So like you get a shitty show like Game of Thrones, and it's not like we whoopsie doodled into that. Like a lot of people approved all the things along the way to get there. So anyway, the internet's reacting to these things, I think, appropriately. And I would submit two things. One, if you're in marketing, if for some reason you're talking in your script for a commercial about genetics, and you're not like a cancer research company or something, or a doctor, stop. Because there's no reason any clothing or food or makeup or whatever should be talking about the genetics of the people. I had a second thing and now I forgot what it was. If I remember it as we keep talking, I'll come back. But there's no reason to be talking about genetics in advertisement. It doesn't make any sense. You don't need to do that. So there you go. That's the internet goss. All right, what's your second story? You have actual news?
I have an actual story about pierogies in space.
Okay, I'm here for it.
So what happened was in July, the second Polish astronaut went into space, second ever. And he went up on a Dragon capsule, spent 20 days or so in the ISS, the International Space Station. And one of the things he did, he brought pierogies.
Oh, you sent me this picture. Yes. He sent me this picture. And I was like, is that AI?
So that was kind of a joke. But so there's a couple of interesting things about this guy. He's 39 years old, I believe.
Oh, wow.
His name is Sławomir Uznański-Wiśniewski.
You know, I challenge you to guess in the comments how many W's are in this name.
So he's an engineer. He worked, he has a PhD, and I'm not sure exactly which discipline, I forgot to look up. He worked at CERN, which is the the European research organization that researches high energy physics. Mm-hmm. And then he joined ESA, which is the European NASA, basically. Mm-hmm. And from June 25th to July 15th, he was in space. The launch was actually conducted by an American company. It's a private company that used the SpaceX rockets to take people up.
Where did they launch from?
United States, Texas.
Yeah.
So the cool thing about him, he actually, the very first astronaut, a Polish astronaut, flew in 1978.
Oh, it's been a long time.
Long time, yeah. Oh, wow. And it flew on the Russian Soyuz spacecraft.
We're Polish. That's why we care about this, by the way. I don't think they know. And pierogies are, how do you describe a pierogi? They're delicious. They're like little sacks full of potatoes, but it's like pasta, kind of, I guess.
Yeah, it's pasta. It's like a...
It's like a little...
Kind of Polish ravioli.
It's like a Polish ravioli. It's but full of potatoes and sometimes onions and cheese. They're very good. Strong recommend pierogies. Would definitely take the space.
So the kind of interesting thing about him, you know, his name is kind of crazy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But so what happened was he actually just got married this year.
Mm-hmm.
And... this is very woke.
Mm-hmm.
When he got married, the couple changed the names to combine the last names.
Aww.
So his names used to be Uznański, and his wife was Wiśniewska.
Mm-hmm.
So now he's Uznański-Wiśniewska.
Aww, that's so nice.
Anyway, so he came back July 15th, and you know, a successful mission. He was a mission specialist.
Aww, that's so nice. Oh, look at that.
So,
woke Polish astronaut. Love him. Eating pierogies in space. I bet he got that idea and he was like, man, I have the best prank.
No, actually, they had the pierogies were like prepared by like a famous chef in Poland.
Really?
So, oh, yeah. So it wasn't... And he also... another thing that he brought with him was he took a flag that the first Polish astronaut took to space back in 78. So he also and I think the other guy is still alive, so he was you know, they were talking and things like that. So it was very cool.
Oh, that's nice.
Anyway, that's my good story.
Oh, fantastic.
Pierogi is a very, very, very Polish dish. So we eat them for Christmas. We eat them. It is also a comfort food. It is very, very homey. And wherever I lived, and I lived in so many different countries, in France, in Germany, in Switzerland, in England, in Norway, I always made pierogi myself and made other people taste them just to share a bit of culture, a bit of Poland, and a bit of who we are.
So my second story, I don't know if it's a good story or if it's just more goss from the internet.
Goss is always fun.
It's an interesting story, and I'm curious what you think, because you're a big reader, and you've been a reader now for quite some time, is my understanding.
Yes.
So this is more book talk drama. So this is more things off of happening on book talk. Now, I'll tell you the story in pieces, and I can stop and ask you questions as we go, and then I'll give you more information, because it's not complicated, but it just continues to unfold. So one thing you have to understand about book talk is that people who are self-publishing, also known as indie authors, use book talk to advertise their self-published books. So there's self-publishing, where like you write a book and you take on all of the responsibility of like the editing and the publishing and the distribution. You like do everything yourself, which is a perfectly valid way to release a book. And then there's traditional publishing, where you write a book and then you submit it to an agent and you do like a different process. Right. Now, unfortunately, indie books kind of have this reputation of being kind of shitty, because some of them are. Because some people write one draft and then put it up on Goodreads or whatever and say, read my book. And it didn't get editing or it didn't go through any steps. Like it was just published because that person was happy with it and they wanted to do that, and that's fine. The traditional publishing track, because it's so much more cutthroat, generally you get a higher quality, but then there's books like Twilight that were traditionally published. So not always. So it's kind of hit and miss. So the indie author community on BookTok is very supportive of each other, and I have a lot of friends that are indie authors. I read their stuff and I comment and push it and whatever and that kind of thing to help them out, because there is quite a lot of good literature in indie publishing. So there's this young woman, I'll call her. She's 22 years old. Her name is Audra Winters, and she has been marketing her upcoming book like really aggressively for a while, but she got like a really big following. And she's like, oh, I'm releasing this first book. It's called Age of Scorpius. It's the first book in this series. And she kept advertising that she had been working on this for 10 years. And in my head, I'm like, you're 22, which means you've been working on it since you were 12, which means this is the book you're writing when you're in middle school and high school. And I did that too. And my book that I wrote in that time was terrible. But that's okay, because it helped me learn how to write better for later projects. And that's fine. That's what writing is supposed to be. But she advertised this book like crazy and got tons of pre-orders on the book, like thousands of pre-orders. Without providing any samples, like no prior writing, no short story, no sample chapter, no, like, I'm doing an event online and I'm reading a chapter out, nothing. No concept. Just that we all knew she had this idea that people were interested in. She had a team. She had hired artists and editors. She had like, all these things. Mm-hmm. She releases the book. It's terrible. Apparently, it's awful. I haven't gotten to read it because within like 2 days, she pulled it.
Oh.
So, yeah. So the internet, as the internet does, overreacted. And thus an interesting debate began. So she releases this book. It's awful. It's got like typos and grammatical errors and like clearly was never edited. And so people begin to ask, like, you said you did all this work, but this is the product. Like, were you scamming us? And then there are people asking for like refunds from having paid for it and all this kind of stuff. And then there was some like really, there was like critique of the writing, which is perfectly fair. But then there was some like straight up like bullying of her and piling on and that kind of thing. So a few interesting debates cropped up. So the first one that I'm interested in what you think. The first debate that cropped up was everybody read it and reacted overwhelmingly poorly and were leaving critical comments. And the question became, is it too much to do critique? Like, should you do critique of an author's book, basically? People were like, you're being too mean by critiquing the book. Like, she worked really hard, but you're critiquing it and you're being too mean. So I'm curious, what do you think just about that in isolation? And then I'll proceed with more information.
Sorry. You have to be able to take criticism if you want to put out your art into the world. Mm-hmm. I know there are musicians who don't read reviews of the records or whatever, mm-hmm. or playwrights who don't read reviews of plays. They're just I wrote it, here's what it is, and you know. Mm-hmm. saying that you put work into it means nothing, you know. Effort, just because you work hard at something doesn't make the result necessarily good. Mm-hmm. I mean, it may be good for you, you develop the muscle or something, but on the other side, there is like, you know, there are people to who stuff seems effortless and you really hate them.
Yeah. Like all those musical savants, all those kids that can play any instrument.
there's a new guitar player coming up, jazz guitar player who's 17. He's mm-hmm. amazing. He's from New Jersey.
Oh.
And nice guy. I just, you know, I've seen him on YouTube and I listened to some interviews with him. Very, you know, but he can play.
Yeah.
Whatever you say.
Yeah.
So criticism is valid. I mean, you can probably, sometimes things may get too personal. Mm-hmm. But like, you know, if you're taking money to create something, essentially, which is what she did, mm-hmm. sounds like she did, then maybe the people who paid the money have a right, so to speak, to me, maybe more critical. Mm-hmm. I've contributed to a bunch of Kickstarter projects for books, mm-hmm. usually Cory Doctorow books, because yeah. he creates his audiobooks. He has like Will Wheaton usually read them, mm-hmm. and that costs money. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't want to publish an Audible for some legal reasons. And there are a couple other. There was a science fiction. There's a science fiction author, Rudy Rucker, who's a bunch of books I've read, and I did like a Kickstarter to a book that he published, and the book turned out to be mm-hmm. I didn't ever finish it. I liked his other books, so you know, it happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of where the debate, that part of the debate, sort of landed, was like, you know, there's no reason to attack someone personally and right. be like, you are a bad person. Like, you don't need to do that. But if you're going to put something creative out there, I mean, even something simple like this podcast, right? Like, we put this podcast out. If someone doesn't like it, they're free to comment on it and not like it. You know, like, that's part of, like, the discourse space.
Another interesting case is Philip K. Dick.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Wow. Are we talking about Philip K. Dick again? Should we talk about Lem next?
So Philip K. Dick, if you read lots of his writing, the writing is not terribly good at times. Mm-hmm. He's got interesting ideas and points of view, but one of his best books, which is called Men in High Castle, is considered the best. And the reason was he worked with an editor who made him rewrite large chunks of the book to make him better. If you read some of short stories that he's written and other stuff, so it's the writing is like, nah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think, like, particularly when it comes to literature, there's so many ways to write. There's so right. many ways to write. I mean, there's a reason. My mom always says this, and I love this. Like, when you walk into a bookstore, it's vast because people want to read different things.
Yep.
It's not like you're not going to write a book where everyone's like, this is amazing. You know, I've been rereading Ulysses by James Joyce.
I read it 5 times.
I love James Joyce. Everyone I talk to is like, why are you doing that? And it's fair because it's a very dense kind of, like, I sit there with Google having to look things up while I'm reading James Joyce. But that's how I engage with literature. People engage with literature in all different ways. But I think ultimately where the debate seems to, and the Audra Winters debate is ongoing But where it seems to have landed for this bit is if you're going to put something out creatively, you have to be able to, you have to prepare yourself for criticism and then decide how you're going to handle it. Because next fact in this is that she puts out the book. It starts to get what is fair critique. I read quite a bit of the critique on Goodreads and a few other platforms. That was critique of the book, not critique of her, not someone being like, you're awful. Like that's not what I'm talking about. Like critique of the book. Her response to the critique, because she started responding,
Ooh.
was not good. And she started basically like telling people they were wrong, which like I don't know what like what's the point of if you think someone's wrong in a comment, what's the point of telling them that in a comment back? Like they're not gonna suddenly change their mind and think they're wrong, you know? Unless you're just trolling for fun. And then she also started making some comments that like the reason the prose was the way it was is because she's autistic and her character is autistic, and therefore, if you don't like it, you're like ableist and stuff like that. And I was like, okay, you're getting that's nobody's saying that. Everyone's just saying you needed to edit more, and you needed to work on the prose. So her response, not great, which then led to more more people critiquing it, and it just sort of ended up in this like terrible little cycle. The other interesting debate that came out of this was a bunch of readers like me, who I didn't participate in this debate. I just kind of watched it happen. But I kind of was thinking this when people first had their reaction. They were like, "Oh my God, this book is terrible." My first thought was like, "Yeah, she's 22. Of course it's terrible. We're not Mary Shelley over here, you know? Like we all
Well,
like."
Norman Mailer, for example, published his first great novel, Naked in the Dead, when he was 24. It was like, 500-page tome, and it was great.
Yeah, and there are those people. You know, Mary Shelley invented science fiction when she was 19.
Yeah, we hate them
So,
all.
yeah, we hate them all. Exactly. They're awful. We hate them. Most of us can't do that, and that's fine. So, like, I was thinking, like, because I've been writing my whole life too, and you've suffered through some of my stories. And when I was 22, I wrote, in 20, 22, 23, 24, I wrote plenty of science fiction, and it was all terrible, but that's okay. That's part of the process of learning how to do this. And so, when she was like, I'm 22 and I've been working on the story for 10 years, I'm like, this is a child's story. So it's not going to be the next great American novel, you know, like it's not. That's just a situation. So a bunch of people had that reaction to the people having the bad reaction to the story, where so then a bunch of people online came on and were like, "Why did you pre-order a book and pay for it when you have never seen this author's writing? She is 22 and you're expecting it to be great. Like you paid for what you should have expected. Like your expectations were wrong, basically." Which, I don't know, did you have any thoughts about that?
Well, it's probably not a lot of money, right? So you do a gamble. Says, "Well, top, I like that kind of a subject, let's say, and maybe something will come out of it." And that doesn't prevent you from criticizing it when he says, "Oh, well, I wasted $20 on this," or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. So that's the kind of debate that's going on. So it seems like now she's pulled the book from like the various platforms, so I can't get my hands on it because now I want to read it. I kind of think she should keep it out there and just ride the buzz and then just release the next book and do better next time. But she pulled it, and she put up some videos about how she's, you know, absorbing the critique and she's going to be making changes or whatever. To which I'm like, if you already, she said she hired. She said she
Crowdsource
hired two editors. That's what's confusing. It's very confusing that she's, because I'm wondering if what happened, and this is just wild speculation, and this is because when I was in my early 20s, I also wrote, and this is how I was. I wonder if she hired people to edit and they made critique and suggestions and she just didn't take them. Because I know what it's like when you're that age and you're like, just your soul is entwined with that story, and someone tells you, like, hey, this thing in the story doesn't make sense. You're like, it couldn't possibly be different. It must be this way. Like, I remember, did you read, I wrote that horribly long science fiction story, The Matchling. You read the first one of
I read a
that?
bunch of them,
Yeah, a
yeah.
bunch of that. So it's a science fiction story. Someday I'll go back to it. But I wrote the first book happening on two separate planets. And I had, like, they go to one planet, they do shit, and then they leave, and they go to a second planet and do shit. And I had one of my readers be like, why don't they just go to one planet so you don't have that part in the middle where they're just, like, flying? And I was like, how could you possibly say that it could be one? The cultures are completely different. And then I thought about it for a few years, and I was like, no, they were right. That's correct.
It's like Harry Potter, yeah. The last book, right?
Oh, the last book of Harry Potter was awful. Besides the fact that She Who Must Not Be Named is a terrible person now. When I was a kid and I read the seventh book, I complained to you and Mom about it. I was like, it's full of filler. It was just them camping all book. And that needed to be edited. But by that point, the series was so big, no one was going to tell.
Right.
Don't tell the author no, you know. And I think, like you're saying, you need to be able to take critique on anything you create. You know, whether that's a fucking TikTok video or YouTube or a song that you put out or a book that you put out. I mean, all the great, like all the really great artists that you see are people that have been, well, except for those special people that are.
Well, no, I mean, there's always competition. And, yeah. And I was thinking about when I was at my band camp, there were like two sections. There was one for the instrumentalists, there was one for singers. Mm. And when we were having lunch talking about stuff, somebody asked, there was a man there who was a singer, and he was kind of dragged there by a friend of his, and he didn't know what to expect. He had a pretty good voice, pretty good singer, and he was surprised by like the welcoming atmosphere of the class and stuff. And he said, is that like that when you knew most of the people from New York? Is it like that when you're working in New York? He said, no, absolutely not. It's a cutthroat competition.
Yes. But it is. And it takes a lot of work and practice. So like I'm going to plug a singer that I like that I discovered. His name is Kane Colto. Mm-hmm. C-A-I-N. And then it's C-U-L-T-O. Kane Colto. He is making fascinating music. That's like, it's a little vulgar. I'll give you, it's a little vulgar, but like that's the style. But it's like a mix because he's initially from Kentucky. Then he was raised in Florida. And he's Latino, he's gay, and he was like raised very Christian, but then came out of like left the church. Mm-hmm. So it was a really interesting background. And so he sings about like the clash of those cultures, basically, in a fascinating way. And so one of his songs, KFC Santeria is the name of the song, came out on TikTok and kind of blew up and sort of blew him up, which is great. Now he's coming out with more music. And he's talked about the process of making that song. And he's been making that song for literally years. And he's had like 10 different versions of it until he landed on the final one. And he's like classically educated in music. Like he went to music school, like all of these things. Like he like buckled down in his education on it and then worked and worked and worked and worked until he got something that really broke through. And sometimes that's what happens.
Well, sometimes somebody sits down and writes a song in 5 minutes and...
Yeah, fuck those people.
No. Some of the greatest songs were written like that.
Yeah. Well, you were telling me about The Martian, right? Was like a book that
Andrew Weir, yeah.
Yeah, that he
published it as a series in his blog, and people were giving him feedback and ultimately became a book.
Yeah.
But
didn't he try to, I thought he tried to get it published for a while and he wasn't getting anywhere, so then he published it to his blog.
I don't know. No, I know it was a blog.
You know who had a hard time getting published? James Joyce.
Really?
Yeah. So actually, in the beginning of the copy of Ulysses I got, there's a letter from James Joyce to the American publisher of his book being like, good luck getting this published in America because I had a hell of a time here in Europe. And he describes the process and he's like, nobody wanted to publish Portrait and then nobody wanted to publish Dubliners. And then I wrote this, Ulysses, and nobody wanted to even read it because it was too long. And he got rejected by like lots and lots of people, and it's in some circles it's considered one of the best books ever written. Well, you know,
that's why there are so many books.
That's why there are so many books in the library, and I do hope that Audrey Winters and other indie authors, because one thing I've seen is that other indie authors on TikTok are now like, oh, I'm afraid to release mine because I'm seeing the backlash to her, and like people critiquing it. And I do hope that she's not discouraged because she's so young. And the fact that she finished a book, you know, like most people at 22 can't say they actually finished writing a book, you know. She finished a book and she's put this work in. Like, she's plenty of room to grow and to continue to write. And I hope she does. And I hope that the other indie authors that see it aren't so desperately discouraged or frightened that they stop, you know.
I think so. Ursula Le Guin said something very wise about this kind of stuff. Somebody asked her about the meaning of one of her books or stories. Mm-hmm. And she says, I don't know, whatever, you know, I just wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
It's up to you to interpret it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
I think that's a good outlook. I think sort of one thing I've developed as I've gotten older with all of my media that I create is sort of a separation between like myself and the product. Like whenever I talk about writing of any kind, I'm always like, the text says. And that makes it easy. I mean, it makes it easier for me to like, you know, try to be more objective about critiquing it and making changes and taking feedback, because you need to, because otherwise you end up with a book that's published with typos and mistakes and everybody hates it. So I think you were right when you said you need to be, you either need to know how to take the critique and like be prepared for it or just ignore it.
Yeah. And just, yeah. Many artists do.
Yeah.
There used to be an internet group of guitar players and stuff, and people, you know, guitar players, as any other artists, you know, compare each other and mm-hmm. whatever. And somebody once said, you know, I'm the best guitar player in the style of me.
Absolutely.
And that's the point of the whole thing, right? Mm-hmm. You know, someone said, you know, somebody was commenting somebody's playing, and he says, oh no, I made so many mistakes. He says, that's fine. Mm-hmm. You know, a computer could play it straight without any mistakes, but the mistakes are yours. You know, that's the...
So this actually, I meant to make this point, this actually kind of comes back tangentially to our AI conversation, because mm-hmm. we didn't have any straight AI stories, of the things people like. You know, people like the individual voice.
Right.
They want the uniqueness of you. Then, and that's why like the AI slop is AI slop, because it's a computer reproducing, attempting to be human, but not, you know, succeeding. And
it's synthetic text generation. So
right, exactly. So, you know, and it's one of those things where people want to, you know, the story is not unique. Audra Winter's story about a magic system based on the zodiacs is absolutely not the first one to exist.
Right.
The zodiacs have existed for many hundreds of years. People have written that shit. But the question is, how does she write it? You know, if you're going to write, like, I'm reading a zombie story now, I love it. There's a bajillion zombie stories. How do you write your zombie story? How do you write your spaceship story or your, you know, Philip K. Dick crazy?
Right.
Or your Stanislav Lem Solaris. I'm gonna reread Solaris soon. You know, alien encounter story. Like, these are all, these ideas are recycled, which is fine. But the question is, how does the individual do it? And the tie I was going to make to AI was that I think people are still and continuously searching for high quality content that has like feeling to it. And I don't think AI at this point, at least, can produce.
Well, it's content that you want to relate to it, right? So it's like mm-hmm. When you're reading a book, you're talking about humans and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Yeah. So, okay, that was my gossip. Okay, thank you for joining us on Downsampled News. Anything else?
No.
No.
We'll see you.
We'll see you next month. Hopefully everything is still here by then. All right, bye, everybody.
Bye.
But I'm not going to move it because it's centered correctly. I'm not going to move the chair. I'm going to step over the chair because the chair is in the right position.
You should put tapes on.
Yeah, for once. I honestly should tape it down. Okay, I'll leave it as that.